All right. Well, grab your Bibles and open them up to Job chapter 32. We are continuing today through the book of Job, this story of a man who was afflicted and who is now trying to figure out and make sense of this suffering in relation to God. Now, chapters 3 through 31 of the book of Job are this back and forth between him and his friends. And so it's this throwing out ideas about why Job is suffering and then Job not agreeing with it and kind of just processing through what it all means. And we finished with that last week. And today what we're going to have is we're going to have this mysterious figure come into the conversation. It turns out Job has a fourth friend who apparently has been there the whole time. Fourth friend who was not introduced to us in chapter 2 with the other three, and someone who has not spoken up to this point. And so today he is going to finally speak, having listened to what everyone else said, feeling like God was not fairly represented. He is going to emerge simply to rebuke everyone involved. And so that's where we are today. Job last week kind of declared where he stands, what he sees is true. We're waiting for God to respond. We know God is going to respond. And in the meantime, here comes Elihu, and he has some thoughts. So Job chapter 32, starting in verse 1, this is what he says. It says, "So these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Then Elihu, the son of Barakel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, burned with anger. He burned with anger at Job because he justified himself rather than God. He burned with anger also at Job's three friends because they had found no answer, although they had declared Job to be in the wrong. Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were older than he. And when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, he burned with anger." All right, as I said before, this character of Elihu is a bit mysterious. People don't know what to do with him. So people who have studied the Bible, studied the book of Job, kind of have different approaches as to how we should hear and read what he has to say. Some people see in his words a similarity to the other three friends, and so they kind of see him as a character to dismiss. He's wrong like they were. While he does say some of the same things, I believe that he says them in a different way, and so we should hear him differently. This combined with the fact that he was kind of set apart, that he's speaking kind of at a different period in the dialogue, and that in chapter 42, when God rebukes Job's other three friends, he doesn't rebuke Elihu. All this together, I think, means that this character stands apart. We need to hear him differently. And I believe his statements make the most sense if we hear him as a prophet of God, preparing Job and us for God to speak directly. That is, Elihu comes in to set the tone for God's declaration by helping us make sense of everything that's been said up to this point. And he does this, as it tells us numerous times, in a fit of righteous anger. It tells us numerous times he burned with anger, he's angry, he is angry. And he's angry at Job, it says, because he had justified himself rather than God. And Elihu is mad at Job's three friends because they had found no answer. And so his issue with Job is that he feels like Job has spent all of this time defending himself, and that through that he has lost sight of what God is doing. So his anger at Job is that Job has allowed his defensiveness to blind him from the good work of God. Now, if we go back and think through Job and what Job has said up to this point, Job did numerous times point to God's control, to God's wisdom, to God's truth. And yet, he has not been able to imagine that God actually might be doing something good in his suffering, right? So suffering was always kind of pulled out and set aside as this terrible thing. Now, to be fair to Job, when you are in the midst of deep personal pain and disillusionment, that doesn't necessarily pop into your head first. So, I mean, I think we can give him a little bit of flack here. So Elihu, I think, is a little bit critical of Job, but at the same time, he's going to take that, he's going to take his anger and use it in a positive way. That is to say, Elihu is going to use his anger at Job in order to force him to ask a different question. Instead of, "What have I done to deserve this?" which has been kind of Job's approach to the issue up to this point, Elihu is going to direct him to ask, what can I learn about God in this? And so Elihu is going to use his anger to help Job and prepare Job to hear God. And what he's frustrated about that the other three friends for is that they haven't done this. Right? He's angry at the other three friends that in all of their talk, in all of their, they've stayed in this very narrow view of the situation. Right? They spent their time accusing Job and kind of throwing out simple ideas that misrepresented God. And so Elihu's been listening and listening and waiting for one of these older, wiser men to say something right, to speak truth to Job. And while Job has had his moments of clarity, he has not been able to piece these things together to create a worldview, a proper view of God and how God works in his creation. And so Elihu can't sit back anymore. Right, this is how he describes how he's feeling in this moment. In verse 19, he says, "Behold, my belly is like wine that has no vent, like new wineskins ready to burst. I must speak that I may find relief. I must open my lips and answer. I will not show partiality to any man or use flattery toward any person, for I do not know how to flatter. Else my maker would soon take me away." And so Elihu just basically says, here I come, right? I'm going to be very direct. I'm going to be very straightforward. Now, he's not going to be cruel like the other friends. He's not going to necessarily attack Job, but he's not going to be anything less than honest. And so he just jumps right in. He starts by going after Job's claim of being innocent. And so in chapter 33, verse 5, he says, "Answer me if you can. Set your words in order before me. Take your stand. Behold, I am toward God as you are. I too was pinched off from a piece of clay. Behold, no fear of me need terrify you. My pressure will not be heavy upon you. Surely you have spoken in my ears, and I have heard the sound of your words. You say, I am pure, without transgression. I am clean, and there is no iniquity in me. Behold, he finds occasion against me. He counts me as his enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks and watches all my paths. Behold, in this you are not right. I will answer you, for God is greater than man." So all through the book of Job, all through the conversations with his three friends, they continually connected Job's suffering to punishment. They always imagined there was hidden sin in Job's life. There was something that he just wasn't telling everybody else. And so their answer was that hidden sin, that is why God is acting in this way towards you. This suffering is the justice of God towards your hidden sin. They refused to believe that Job's suffering could be anything else, that he might actually be struggling for another reason. And Job, over and over again, has rejected this, right? And as we saw at the beginning of the book, actually, Job is right in this. He is not suffering because of his sin. He is suffering, actually, because of his righteousness, right? Satan is testing his faith because of God kind of putting him out there as a example of the fear of God. In defending himself, though, Job has overstated his purity, right? He has kind of created a vision of himself that is a little bit better than who he actually is. And so Elihu comes to him here, not to speak down to him like the other friends did, not to take a holier-than-thou position, but to empathize with him as another human being. Now, often when we hear the word empathy, we think about a move towards compassion, a softening, a gentleness. Empathy is an understanding of another person based on shared experience. And so a good portion of the time when you empathize with someone, you understand their motives, you understand why they did something, and so you are more gracious towards them. But as we see here, empathy can also help you to see through another person's lies. And it can help you to see through another person's lies because you understand their lies because you tell yourself the same things. And sometimes the best thing for us is a person who is honest and empathetic, who doesn't hold back because they understand that the lies we tell ourselves are destructive. And this is the position that Elihu takes. Elihu's shared humanness with Job helps him to recognize the error that Job is making. As a creature approaching the Creator, Elihu understands what it means to want to be right before God. right? To be able to stand before God and be declared worthy. That's something every human being desires. We all want to be declared good. Yet none of us are. And so Elihu wants to point Job to this, the reality of this situation. He says, you are not without transgression. You are not clean. You are not without iniquity. In this, he says, you are not right. Now, the difference between what he is saying here and what the other three friends have said is that Elihu is not placing Job in a separate category apart from himself, right? He's not coming to Job and saying, you're a sinner and I'm not. You deserve the justice of God and I don't. You need to come to God in the way that I have and then everything will be fine, right? This was kind of the way his friends approached it. Instead, Elihu is emphatically declaring all creation as rebellious against its creator. And this is an important distinction. Because if you pick up on this distinction, you no longer look out at the world as the good people and the good people and the bad people, right? You don't separate categories like that because you recognize all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. All have rejected their creator. A world that was designed to be in perfect relationship with him has chosen to believe in themselves and trust their own understanding. And when you start to look out on the world that way, when you start to see all of humanity in that way, it changes how you view what is happening all around us. And so Elihu wants to set that as the starting point. He says, Job, we're going to ask some new questions. We're going to look at things a little bit differently, but we're going to start from this point, recognizing that we are all sinners approaching a holy God. Now, with that, he's then is going to try to make sense of some of the pain and suffering Job might be going through. In chapter 33, verse 13, he says this. He says, why do you contend against him, saying he will answer none of man's words? For God speaks in one way and in two, though man does not perceive it. In a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls on men while they slumber on their beds, then he opens the ears of men and terrifies them with warnings, that he may turn man aside from his deed and concealed pride from a man. He keeps back his soul from the pit, his life from perishing by the sword. And so Elihu then takes this truth that we are all sinners before God, and he takes it to kind of answer another one of Job's, a second claim that Job has made. Job has made the claim up to this point that God is not answering him, right? He's saying, I can't hear God, I can't sense God. God no longer is there for me. And Elihu's answer to that is that God is always speaking. He's not always going to give you a verbal answer or respond in the way that you expect. Sometimes he will, right? And he goes into examples here about God speaking through dreams or speaking directly to people. He says, that's one way that God communicates. And in the book of Job, that's what we'll look at next week. God will speak directly to Job. But other times, Elihu says, God speaks in our lives, and he speaks specifically through our pain. This is how he describes it, verse 19. Man is also rebuked with pain on his bed, and with continual strife in his bones, so that his life loathes bread and his appetite the choicest food. His flesh is so wasted away that it cannot be seen, and his bones that were not seen stick out. His soul draws near the pit and his life to those who bring death. What Elihu's getting at here is that God uses the pain of this broken creation to rebuke or chasten his people. Now, this rebuke he's talking about here is not punishment or condemnation. It's God actually using suffering as a tool for shaping us. He's saying that God uses moments of deep suffering in our lives to draw us to himself. Now, I can say that, but that sounds kind of crazy. It sounds a little bit cruel. And people often push back against this idea, right? How dare God use pain to teach me a lesson? I'd rather he just leave me alone. Let me figure it out on my own. Well, that only makes sense if you have hope apart from him. See, that's why Elihu started where he did, with the universal condition of sin that we are all under. We are all deserving of God's wrath. We are all in this predicament. The question is, are we going to recognize that and seek help? Without struggle and pain, we won't. And so God chastening us through pain is his work to open our eyes to the reality of our situation. And if we need him, if this is actually what we were created for and what our deepest and best is, then the most loving thing that God can do is whatever it takes to get us to recognize this. Now in this, Elihu is now opening up some other ways that God might use pain and suffering. Pain and suffering is not just the action of God against those he is angry at, as his other friends had simplified. No, sometimes it is the very means by which God lovingly guides and directs those that he cares about. Author of Hebrews echoes this. In Hebrews chapter 12, he says, "For they, being our earthly fathers, disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it." In this description, then, suffering is discipline, and this discipline is for our good. Right? God is lovingly using the difficult things of this life to break down our apprehension to him. And it isn't fun. Right? Hebrews says, it seems painful rather than pleasant. Not seems. It is. It is painful rather than pleasant. But it has to be painful. Because this discipline has to shake us out of this idea that we are all rooted in, that we know what's best for us, that we can handle it, that we can fix our own situation, that we can stand before God on our own merit. And so God has written his plan through pain and suffering, using what is terrible to bring about redemption. And how does he bring about that redemption? Elihu tells us. Verse 23. It says, "If there be for him an angel, a mediator, one of the thousand, to declare to man what is right for him, and he is merciful to him and says, 'Deliver him from going down into the pit. I have found a ransom. Let his flesh become fresh with youth. Let him return to the days of his youthful vigor.' Then man prays to God and he accepts him. He sees his face with a shout of joy, and he restores to man his righteousness. He sings before men and says, 'I sinned and perverted what was right, and it was not repaid to me. He has redeemed my soul from going down into the pit, and my life shall look upon the light.'" So God opens our eyes to our need. He helps us to understand our place in this creation through suffering. And then he provides for us the salvation that we need from our sin. Because when we get to the point where we recognize how broken we are, this sinful position before God, on our inability to rectify it, it places us absolutely at the need of God's mercy. Because we have no ability to fix it. We're desperate. We're in need. And it's at this point that Elihu brings in the idea of the mediator, the one who will act as a ransom, the one who will deliver us from going down into the pit. "Because of him," Elihu says, "the man prays to God and he accepts him. He sees his face with a shout of joy, and he restores to the man his righteousness." This is the process of redemption. We recognize our sin. God reveals what this sin means, right? The wages of sin is death. And we're faced with this situation that we cannot repair. And as we stare that in the face, in steps Jesus, the mediator, to stand between human beings and a holy God, to absorb the wrath that we deserve, so that we can receive a righteousness that we have not earned. And when we understand that story, when we understand the part that we play in it, we are the rescued people who rebelled against God that he came to save. Then when we look upon the face of that mediator, we look upon it with a shout of joy, is what Elihu says. Everything else of this life now flows from the gratitude that we have for being saved. Elihu describes the joy here in a song, and I mentioned to first service, I've never really looked at this before, but this is going on a plaque on my wall now. This is what he says. I sinned and perverted what was right, and it was not repaid to me. He has redeemed my soul from going down into the pit, and my life shall look upon the light. Elihu is challenging Job here to see his suffering as discipline that leads to redemption. Now, this is going to have implications now of how Job looks at all of life, all the things that he's been pondering. And Elihu starts by now applying this to the issue of justice. This is what he says in chapter 34, verse 9. He says, "For he," that's Job, "has said, it profits a man nothing that he should take delight in God. Therefore, hear me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God that he should do wickedness, and from the Almighty that he should do wrong. For according to the work of man he will repay him, and according to his ways he will make it befall him. Of a truth, God will not do wickedly, and the Almighty will not pervert justice. Who gave him charge over the earth, and who laid on him the whole world? If he should set his heart to it and gather himself, his spirit, and his breath, all flesh would perish together, and man would return to dust." And so what we see is Elihu now is responding to one of the claims that Job made earlier in the book, that delighting in God or following God is of no profit. Specifically, Job's complaint, if you remember, was that he looked upon the wicked, he looked upon the righteous, and their lives looked the same. Right, they both experienced some good things, some bad things. They both died, and both of them had someone tending to their tombstone, is kind of how he put it. And so he's kind of like, so what's the point? Right, justice would say that there's a difference in these two lives, and yet they look the same from where we stand. Now, Elihu's answer to that is to point to the perfect justice of God, which is similar to the other friends. God will not do wickedly. He can't. His very nature is just. And so the whole idea even of justice in this world, that there is good and bad, that there is something that deserves to be punished, comes from the nature of the Creator. But God's perfect justice demands that every single thing be made right. Right? All have sinned, which kind of puts us in a predicament. Because if we are sinners and everything needs to be put right, oh no, right? And if we want quick and direct justice, like sin happens justice, right? At the moment that we sin at any point in this life, we're done. So this is what Elihu is getting at when he says, if he should set his heart to it and gather to himself his spirit and his breath, all flesh would perish together, all man would return to dust. He's saying that if God operated on the retribution principle, which is what the other friends were describing, all flesh would perish together. The whole world would be wiped out. No one would make it. Now, as much as we want justice, I don't think any of us actually want that. Right? When we start thinking about justice, we start thinking about scales. You know, we're always on the good side of the scale. So kind of we make up this idea of justice where everyone worse than us is deserving of justice, but like we're over here, and so we create our own system of justice in relation to ourselves. But when we take God's view of justice, when we view the world through that lens, well, then we need mercy. But the other thing that we need is we need time. Right? Because when we talk about discipline and God shaping us and God revealing to us who he is and using suffering to open our eyes, like that all takes life. And so we actually want God to delay justice because God delaying justice actually is what allows people to come to him. Recognizing this makes us very happy that God does not act in the way that we sometimes ask him to act. And we should be thankful for this divine forbearance. That's what Paul calls it in Romans chapter 3. This delayed judgment, because it's what allows us to experience the glory and the grace of God. But let's make sure that we don't read into this delay an absence of justice. Right? Just because we don't see that kind of direct, immediate action does not mean that God is not absolutely acting justly right now. Elihu here assures Job that there will be a perfect justice enacted not only for future events, but for everything that's ever happened. Verse 21, he says, "For his eyes are on the ways of a man, and he sees all his steps. There is no gloom or deep darkness where evildoers may hide themselves. For God has no need to consider a man further, that he should go before God in judgment. He shatters the mighty without investigation and sets others in their place. Thus, knowing their works, he overturns them in the night and they are crushed. Which is to say, there's nothing done. Nothing done on this earth that is not seen by God. And there's nothing done on this earth that is not going to receive a full and complete judgment. There's nowhere that people can hide. There is not anywhere that's out of God's, you know, camera view. And there's no court case where someone may get off on a technicality or because of an unbalanced jury or a skewed justice system. God has no need to examine a man further, which means he doesn't have to sit down and figure out what you might have done. He doesn't have to get you to confess. God knows exactly not only what you've done, but what is in the heart of every single person. And he will bring about perfect justice. Every action will be brought to light, and that we have to hang our hope on that. So the question of why does it matter if we act rightly or not? Well, it all matters. If every single action is fits into God's plan, then every single action matters. And while we may not be able to connect the dots between cause and effect, God working all things together for good means that every deed, good or bad, will either build his kingdom and be part of what lives on eternally, or will be crushed to show his perfect justice. We shouldn't allow our inability to imagine how the pieces fit together to justify sin and unrighteousness. And even though it might seem like evil people are getting away with things all over the place, we must continue to do what is right, both in worship of God, but also in trusting that he will work these things out and that there's great value to living by his order. Now, the only way we can do that is to have a very high view of God, right? The only way that we can act towards what we know, even when what is right in front of us doesn't seem to match that, is to be sure of who he is, that he is actually good and sovereign and cares about us. And so Elihu spends the last two chapters of his dialogue describing who God is. In chapter 36, verse 5, he says this, "Behold, God is mighty and does not despise any. He is mighty in strength of understanding. He does not keep the wicked alive, but gives the afflicted their right. He does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous, but with kings on the throne, he sets them forever, and they are exalted. And if they are bound in chains and caught in the cords of affliction, then he declares to them their work and their transgressions, and they are behaving arrogantly. He opens their ears to instruction and commands that they return from iniquity. If they listen and serve him, they complete their days in prosperity and their years in pleasantness. But if they do not listen, they perish by the sword and die without knowledge." To have a God who is mighty in strength and understanding, and who is working at all times and in all places, this should bring a great peace into our lives. Now, it doesn't take away the difficulty of life. I mean, again, Job is still sitting in the same situation. But what it removes is this great existential burden that being a human being in this world creates. Because if your place in this world is to define and defend who you are, then all of the noise out there, right, all the people telling you what you need to do, what you need to know, what you should be speaking into, how you should prove yourself, right, all of these things that are basically, if you really are a Christian, if you really are a good person, this is what you do, this is how you act, this is what you should know, all of that becomes massively unbearable. And in the information age with the internet, that just keeps on coming. Now, it's not that these things are bad. Many of those things are very good. But they're just too big for us. We can't solve all the problems of this world. We can't even save ourselves. And I think deep down we know this. That's why it's so hard. Because when we look at the problems and we go, somebody should do something about that, we know deep down, man, I don't have the power or the strength or the ability. I think this is why mental health and depression rates are flying through the roof. because we just got this stuff in front of our faces all the time. And it just makes us feel more and more and more overwhelmed. And we deal with that by either being really busy, because if I'm really busy, I can kind of distract myself from ever thinking about that, or we're paralyzed in despair. But there is another way. Elihu points us here to rest in God's greatness. And to rest in God's greatness is to trust absolutely that he has it in his hands. At that point, then, you can live faithfully in his order because it is what is best for the world. You can acknowledge your limitations and your inability and just do that little bit that you can, hopeful, as you take one step at a time. Because this life is long and brutal and full of pain, and no one has made it through without experiencing some or a lot of that. But this life is also the means by which a great God is revealing his glory and his grace to us if we are willing to listen. And this is where Elihu ends, chapter 37, pointing us to listen. 37 verse 1, it says, "At this also my heart trembles and leaps out of its place. Keep listening to the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that comes from his mouth. Under the whole heaven he lets it go, and his lightning to the corners of the earth. After it his voice roars, he thunders with his majestic voice, and he does not restrain the lightnings when his voice is heard. God thunders wondrously with his voice. He does great things that we cannot comprehend." In this we see, as we've said, God's majesty gives us a place to rest. But this whole thing about the thunder and the lightning and the power of God is supposed to show us that resting is not the only thing we're supposed to be doing in this life. We have a God who is at work in this world, and his voice thunders throughout his whole creation. Now, there's certainly times in life like Job here where basically holding on and just making it through, just getting up and out of bed in the morning is all you can do. I mean, that takes every bit of effort. But life is also filled with all sorts of moments for us to use the strength that has been given to us by God to act on behalf of him in his creation. And this strength doesn't come from like, man, I have this in me, or believing that you are able to solve all problems. Our strength comes from the assurance that every action and effort put forth in line with God's active plan is effective. Your labor is not in vain. Every little bit you do for God is magnified by his voice and his power to build his kingdom. Even if it feels really, really, really small in the moment. And so we have both this peace and this strength. But we must remember we only have them in relation to God. Right? He does great things that we cannot comprehend. Which means we need to keep our relationship to God first and foremost. We need to be careful as well in taking the truths of the Bible and applying them beyond what God has clearly said in ways that are beyond how he intended them to be used. Now, that work of kind of application and discernment in this world is something we always have to do. God did not speak into each and every situation that would come up throughout the history of the world, and so we have to be really good at looking out of this world through the lens of God. But we also need to be careful in how we do that. We also need to make sure that we aren't just kind of taking these things of God and basically pulling them away from him and applying them apart from him. And what this takes is humility. It takes humility to recognize that things are not as clear and as simple as we want them to be. One of the things that's been happening a lot is people are declaring things that they're so sure of. Right? Declaring things like, again, if you are a Christian, this is what you do. If you are a Christian, this is how you should act. If you are a Christian, this is where you should align. And a lot of what is being done in that is again, well-intentioned and yet What's being done is the things of God are being applied outside of the realm of God in ways that can get us into trouble. I think this example of God using pain and suffering to discipline us is a good example for us. Most of us approaching Job here would be trying to get Job out of his difficult position, trying to help Job, and that's in some ways what his other friends were doing. Job, how can we get you to not be suffering anymore? Elihu's the one who comes along and says, actually, what you need to do is see God in your suffering. You need to figure out who God is and what he's doing. God prioritizes our relationship with him. We should be doing the same thing. Elihu ends here by reminding us of this. Verse 23, he says this, "The Almighty, we cannot find him. He is great in power. Justice and abundant righteousness he will not violate. Therefore, men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit." And so what we need to do is learn how to fear God and how to live humbly towards others. And if we do that, what ends up happening is a lot of the answers that we're looking for and thinking that we can grasp, they actually kind of play out in front of us. When we try to fully grasp all the things of this world and make sense of everything, we get overwhelmed. And we say, you know what? How can I best worship God in this moment? What does it look like to follow God's order and righteousness in this moment? That's something we might actually be able to find an answer to. And so fearing God and living humbly towards others will produce the answers and life that God is working out in us. But as I said, to get there requires humility. It requires admitting we don't have all the answers. Now, humility should not be a hard thing for a Christian. We started today by saying basically like, hey, our starting point is that we are sinners coming before a holy God. Like, if that's how we view ourselves, being humble towards other people who are all in the same boat should not be that complicated. We are a people who declare our need for salvation. We are people who declare we are hopeless without Jesus. And yet it's so easy for us to forget that. I'll just go here. As you come forward then for communion today, come reflecting on the song of Elihu, because I believe that the only way that we actually are able to maintain that sort of humility within suffering and chaos and brokenness is to remind ourselves over and over and over again what we have been given by God. And so this song of Elihu is a song that is meant to keep us both in fear of God and humble towards others. And it says this, "I sinned and perverted what was right, and it was not repaid to me. He has redeemed my soul from going down into the pit, and my life shall look upon the light." Let's pray. Father, we thank you so much for all that you have done for us, and we admit that we often take it for granted. We all often see it as something secondary to the rest of our lives. We often see it as something that we should set aside so that we can move forward to the bigger things. And yet we're reminded in the story of Job that all of this, all of his pain and his suffering, all of it is to bring him into a deeper relationship with you. We are reminded that you care so much about your people that you discipline those that you love. We are reminded that you are delaying justice specifically so people have the time to come to you. And so I pray that we would be able to see this relationship with you as first and foremost in our lives. I pray that you would help us to see this world through that lens. I pray most of all that you would bring us the immensity of joy that comes from knowing that you have acted on our behalf, that you care for us, that you love us. and that there's nothing that can take that away. Father, be with us as we navigate this world, as we try to make sense of all that we interact with. Help us to be humble. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.